The 10-person unit included two sisters called Dolores and Marion Price. They were of particular importance to the IRA. He was going back into the house when he was overpowered by two men, and he was bundled into another car, and it was driven off at speed.
Thank you very much for sitting down and joining me, David. I finished off the book there a couple of days ago. Very good read. It's one of those books. It's about a specific incident, but it'll increase your knowledge of the whole time period in Ireland and all the people involved. Great book. How would you kind of synopsize it for people when people ask you like what is this book about? What's the answer you give them?
Well, I suppose I would say it focuses on one, as you say, on one particular incident, which was particularly poignant and particularly brutal in some respects. But I hope that through that incident and through a kind of close examination or analysis of what happened, that it opens up a wider perspective and helps give insight into other deaths and other incidents that happened during the Troubles.
Right, I see. Okay, so we'll kind of go back to the beginning with Thomas Niedermeyer. There's a kind of a sad irony in that he very narrowly missed basically going to the front lines of World War II as a Hitler Youth member. If he'd been a couple of years older, there's a kind of a sadness in that he managed to escape this almost po post-apocalyptic world, which would have been Germany at the time, and then later met his end in a country that's usually very peaceful and idyllic and stuff. You might kind of paint a bit of a picture of the world that he and indeed his wife actually escaped from b before they came to her.
Well, they both had pretty disturbing adolescence, childhoods. As you say, Thomas was, I mean, it was compulsory to be a member of the Hitler Youth. It was, you couldn't evade it. He didn't join that by of his own volition. It was mandatory. He joined the Hitler Youth, and in 1942, Hitler Youth members were conscripted into the German war economy. And in a way, he was, as you say, he was fortunate in that if he'd been a little older, he would have been conscripted into the armed forces, as many of his of other members of the Hitler Youth were. He grew up in Bavaria, which was a relatively peaceful part of Germany during World War II. It didn't have a great deal of bombing raids by the Allies. But he was sent after he was conscripted into the German war economy. He was sent to a place called Karlsruhe, which was a center of aircraft production, and that's what he worked as a young boy. And it was very heavily bombed by the Allies. In fact, it was almost completely obliterated. So he although he escaped frontline duties, he certainly experienced the war in a pretty horrendous way. And he was interned as a former member of the Hitler Youth. He was interned by the Americans for 6 months after the war ended. His future wife was born at the opposite end of Germany in an area that was then known as East Prussia. She was one of nine children, and seven of her siblings died during the war, which I think by any standards is a colossal loss. And fairly kind of mind blowing. She managed to escape from the advance of the Red Army as it moved into East Prussia, and she was eventually sent to Bavaria, which had some housing that could accommodate literally millions of refugees from East Prussia and Czechoslovakia and Poland, who had been forcibly expelled at the end of the Second World War. She eventually met Thomas. They fell in love and they got married in 1952. And at that time, his career as a business manager was on the uptake. I mean, I mentioned in my book that he was sometimes described in the Irish press as being a German industrialist or a tycoon, but in fact, he came from a modest working class background. His father was a car mechanic. And part of the reason that he was able to progress in the organization that he had joined, which was Grundig, was because the colossal number of young German men that had been killed in the Second World War. Around 3 million had been killed. So I suppose you might say that on the positive side, that opened up opportunities for young men like Thomas.
Okay, so I knew about a lot of the rapes and the sexual atrocities that the Russians committed as they came in. I knew before reading this that it happened, and I'd heard some horrific accounts. But God, I didn't quite know the scale of it. I think the figure you gave in the book was like 2 million cases.
It became, I mean, it was even encouraged by the Red Army commanders that any women that they encountered, no matter virtually what their age was, were raped and quite often murdered afterwards. Horrendous. And of course, because of this was the Nazi regime that was being toppled, so in the rest of the world, there wasn't a great deal of sympathy for these women. There was a kind of feeling that, well, they got what they deserved, you know, horrible as that may sound. And they got absolutely no psychological support. I mean, for Ingeborg, Thomas's wife, to have lost so many of her family within such a short space of time, to have been expelled essentially from her homeland and never to be able to go back to it. And then to receive no psychological advice or help or support, that was a very severe burden that she carried.
God, I can only begin to imagine. Okay, so the book is kind of essentially the three people, I suppose, that it's about are, of course, Thomas Niedermeyer, his wife we just spoke about, and a third man, Brian Keenan, played a very significant role in indeed the IRA in the early parts of Troubles, and of course in Niedermeyer's kidnap. You might go into his background and what we know about him and his roots.
Brian Keenan, I suppose one of the most unusual things about him is that he knew Thomas Niedermeyer very well. Over a period of really 10 years, he knew him well. He was a shop steward in the factory in Northern Ireland that Niedermeyer managed, and they had many kind of fairly bruising encounters. Keenan was a very, he was, in some respects, he was a little like Thomas Niedermeyer. He was an intelligent man. He was very driven, and he was very determined to get his own way. He was born in County Tyrone. His family had moved there because of, during the Second World War, Belfast had been bombed very extensively, and about half the population moved out, and his family was one of them. However, his father had actually joined the RAF and had served in Britain. In fact, had been decorated for bravery while he was in the RAF. He returned to Northern Ireland, hooked up with his family, and then moved back to Belfast. Keenan began a bit like Niedermeyer. He began training in as an electronics engineer. He moved to England when he was only 16. And he moved in with his brother. There was some incidents of violence. He was arrested on a couple of occasions for either fighting or for vandalism. But he came back in 1962, and he joined the factory that Thomas Niedermeyer was managing. And as I say, they knew each other pretty well. There was a kind of antagonism between them. And Keenan was regarded as being one of the most militant of the shop stewards. And in fact, in one letter, Thomas Niedermeyer says that he has a dispute with him almost every week, leading to a short-term stoppage. So they knew each other well. But in 1966, Keenan was arrested for his role in a riot that took place in Belfast. And that seems to have politicized him. Radicalized him in terms of republicanism. And when the Troubles broke out in 1969, he joined the IRA, and he rose rapidly within the IRA until he became, within actually about 18 months, he was the Quartermaster General of the IRA. He subsequently became chief of staff of the IRA.
He you mentioned there his role in quartermaster. He met actually with a man who played an interesting outside role in the Troubles, which was Colonel Gaddafi. I've interviewed previously Jennifer O'Leary, who wrote a book about Father Patrick Ryan, who also met with him. What can you tell us about his interactions with Gaddafi and what he was up to? I heard Gaddafi or his people maybe found him a bit like difficult to work with.
Yeah, they did. I mean, he wasn't a person who engaged much in small talk. He was quite an intimidating character and quite an impatient character, and they found him difficult to work with. However, he was one of the first to establish direct contact with Gaddafi, and he managed to convince Gaddafi that the IRA were his revolutionary brothers, and that he was under a kind of obligation almost to supply them with arms and money. And he supplied them with both. In fact, he was their major arms supplier throughout the Troubles. The secondary source of arms was North America, and Keenan also visited. He had a variety of false passports, which he used to visit both North America, Irish American centres there, and also the Middle East. But Gaddafi was his main man.
Right. On that note, he also met with Colombian groups, FARC, excuse me. He facilitated a kind of, you call it like a cross-pollination of like insurgency techniques. There was even what was the name of them? The ETA, a Spanish guerrilla group.
The ETA, he was very close to the ETA, actually, which was the Basque separatist group, and he'd close contacts with them, and they exchanged technical information about bomb making, and they exchanged weapons, and they exchanged money. That was one of his major. He had contacts with. When he was eventually arrested, they found a notebook, with which a coded notebook, which showed that he, whenever they broke the code, which wasn't very difficult, they found that he had contacts, extensive contacts, throughout Europe, the Middle East, and North America. In Europe, I suppose one of the main ones would have been ETA. But he also had contacts with groups in Germany, the RAF, the Red Army faction. In fact, on occasion, the RAF completed operations on behalf of the IRA. They killed British soldiers stationed in Germany, and issued and said that it had been done on behalf of the IRA.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, so how was it that two Germans end up living in Northern Ireland?
Well, he joined this company called Grundig, and he'd risen quite rapidly in it. By the time he was 28, he was a senior manager in its headquarters in Nuremberg. Grundig at that time was one of the biggest employers in Europe. It had employed about 45,000, 50,000 people, but all its operations were within Germany. But in the late 50s, early 60s, the Stormont government began to offer considerable financial incentives for factories to move to Northern Ireland. In fact, the strategy that they followed was subsequently picked up and developed by the IDA south of the border. What they would do is they would build factories and then offer them free to companies. The head of Grundig, a guy called Max Grundig, was offered a factory in Northern Ireland, and he was a pretty astute businessman, and he accepted it. And then he asked Thomas Niedermayer if he would be the first manager of the factory. And once again, it's important that to recognise that he was he was an employee of Grundig. Niedermayer was not a shareholder. He wasn't on the board of directors. Directors. He was paid a wage, but he moved to Northern Ireland with his wife, and at first their letters say that they found the accents very difficult to understand. He says that they just nodded and in agreement when that happened, but they settled in very quickly, and the factory became a huge success. It started off with just a couple of hundred workers. By the end of the 1960s, it had more than 2,000. It was supplying around 40% of all the tape recorders sold in the UK. So it was awarded awards of industry, and he was offered an OBE, an Order of the British Empire, and one of the he was very pleased with that because he was very self-conscious that, or very aware, I should say, that he'd left school so early and he w had no qualifications, no formal qualifications, which in Germany at that time were considered very important, still are to a large extent. So when he was appointed as the honorary German ambassador and received this OBE from the British, he was extremely proud of it. He felt that, in fact, when he applied for the position of honorary German ambassador, or consul, I should say, he said that in his application, he said he drew attention to the fact that he had no formal qualifications and said that he hoped that his lack of formal education, which was not of his own volition, was because he'd been drafted into the workforce, would not work against him. And it didn't. And he took it very seriously. Now, at that time, there were only a couple of hundred Germans living in Northern Ireland. So it wasn't a very demanding post. In fact, most of it consisted of bailing out drunken German merchant seamen who've got into fights, usually with prostitutes. It wasn't very onerous. Once again, when it was written about in the Irish press, he was quite often described as a German diplomat. He was not a German diplomat. It was an honorary position, which he was very proud of, but which didn't really involve any sort of high-flying negotiations or anything like that.
Okay, so the other, I guess the other like big kidnapping that comes to people's minds when they think of like the Troubles in the IRA would be Don Tidy. I interviewed an author about an excellent book about that kidnapping. Now, obviously, that was mid-80s, so the context in which it happened, it's a bit different. We were only, I mean, when Niedermeyer was kidnapped, end of December 73. I mean, we're only kind of like we're like essentially less than 4 years into the conflict. You might paint a bit of that picture for us and just kind of show us where the troubles were at and where Northern Ireland was at the time, you know?
Well, I mean, in the early 1970s, very few people believed that the Troubles were going to last for as long as they did. There was a feeling that, yes, this was awful, but it was going to be sorted out. Very, very few people, including Niedermayer, believed that this was going to last for 30 years. That affected him. For example, he refused any special security arrangements. He continued to live in the same area that he had always lived in, or at least had lived in for the previous 10 years, because he thought he was safe. And the reason he thought he was safe was because he had played no part in Northern politics. In fact, he quite often said, "I can't pretend even to understand Northern politics." His factory was regarded by the trade union movement in Northern Ireland as being a model factory, which employed both Protestants and Catholics. Now, it was mainly a Catholic workforce, but not exclusively. It was about 70% Catholic and about 30% Protestant. But Niedermayer himself believed that, in a way, he was exempt from the pressures because his marriage was one of mixed religion, as it would be seen in Northern Ireland. His wife was from the Lutheran North, and he was from the Catholic South. So he felt that he would not allow any displays of political affiliation to be shown in the factory. He was scrupulous about that. He felt he was safe. But in the early 70s, the campaign by the IRA escalated very significantly. And one of the ways in which it escalated was for the first time, an IRA unit was sent to London to bomb London. That was in 1973. And it's quite often forgotten that this was a deliberate decision and a deliberate escalation of the campaign. There had been no bombs in London until March of 1973, and the IRA unit that conducted those bombings followed up a strategy which was never subsequently followed, which was that two cars were hijacked in Belfast. Or four cars, I should say, were hijacked in Belfast. They were driven to Dublin, where they were given false number plates, and they were packed with explosives. They were then driven across on the ferry to Liverpool, and then driven down from Liverpool to London. That's a very long logistical path for the bombs to travel, and this was the only time that they followed this path. They also there were 10 members of the IRA unit involved in this campaign, and they all flew over to London. Either they flew, I should say, or they went by train. And then their plan was to come back that morning. They planted the bombs early in the morning, and they went to Heathrow Airport to fly back. But there had been an informant within the IRA who had tipped off the RUC, who in turn tipped off the Metropolitan Police. The entire unit was arrested at Heathrow Airport. This was a huge setback for the IRA. It also taught them that in future they would not send over units. They would instead embed units in England who would live there and would assemble bombs in England rather than transport them from Ireland. So from their point of view, that made a lot of sense. The 10-person unit included two sisters called Dolores and Marion Price. They were of particular importance to the IRA for several reasons. One of them was that their family had a long-standing association with the IRA that went back decades. In fact, their father had been involved in a previous IRA campaign in England. He'd been interned south of the border, and he'd also been imprisoned north of the border. In addition to that, Dolores and Marion Price were the first women to be allowed to join the IRA. Until then, women were seen in a kind of first aid role or intelligence role or something like that, but these were actual combatants. So they were very important to the IRA. The two sisters were regarded, as one person told me, with a mixture of awe and fear. So Keenan was particularly keen on getting those sisters back to Ireland, where there were different prison regulations. They're allowed to free association with other members of the IRA, et cetera, and they were eligible for better remission. In order to do that, he decided to kidnap his former boss, Thomas, and hold him for ransom. And that's the circumstances in which he was kidnapped.
I see. Okay, so yeah, obviously, yeah, like I said, the Don Tidy one was the aim was financial. They wanted like a big lump of cash to fund the thing. This was this was a trade. Yeah, interesting.
Trade, yeah.
How did the actual eventually doomed kidnapping take place? Oh, funny, sorry, but before that, you mentioned that Niedermeyer's factory was like mainly Catholic. That fact actually saved him, saved his car from getting carjacked off him, because he got stopped by the IRA one night, and they said, oh, he said, oh yeah, by the way, my factory and blah, and just let him go. It was actually it was really not a precursor to his eventual fate, like.
No, but as you say, it also gave him the confidence to believe that he had nothing to fear from the IRA because he'd been in their grip, if you want to put it like that. And they had let him go because they knew that the bulk of people that he employed came from Andersonstown, which was a Catholic area of Belfast. In fact, just a couple of months before he was kidnapped, he went as a surprise guest to his brother's birthday in Germany. And as he was leaving, his sister-in-law said to him, "Please be careful in Northern Ireland. Don't do anything that will get you into danger." And he turned to her and laughed and said, "There's absolutely nothing for me to fear. There's no reason anyone would want to harm me." So What happened was that on the night of the 27th of December, St. Stephen's Day, on the day after St. Stephen's Day, two men called at his house at about 11 o'clock at night, and the only two people in the house were Thomas and his younger daughter, Renata, and they told her that there had been an accident. And they had damaged his car, and they invited him to come outside and look at the car and assess the damage. He was actually in bed at the time, but his young daughter, who was about 13, woke him. He put on his trousers, he put on a pair of slippers, he went out to look at the car, and he saw there was no damage to his car. He was going back into the house when he was overpowered by two men, and he was bundled into another car. And it was driven off at speed. The abduction happened to be witnessed by a neighbor who had got up in the night to get a glass of water. And he saw Thomas being abducted, but he wasn't sure of what exactly it amounted to because he thought it was Christmas. Maybe they're taking him to a party and he's reluctant to go and they're insisting. Thomas's wife, Ingeborg, was in a hospital at the time. And he thought there was a possibility there's an emergency and they need to get him to the hospital fast. So it took almost an hour before he alerted, first of all, the army. And it took another hour before the army alerted the police. By that time, Thomas was already in a so-called safe house, and it was too late to stop the kidnappers.
Right. Usually there's a very kind of there's almost like a set kind of playbook when it comes to kidnappings. You can expect to hear from them with particular demands within a short amount of time. This one didn't quite go like that.
It didn't go that way. There was an initial phone call to the British government that said basically, we've got Niedermayer and we want the Price sisters returned to Northern Ireland. That's basically all it said. And there was no follow-up. So, as you say, it's very unusual for kidnappers only to make one phone call because there needs to be some kind of negotiation, even if you know what you have to do, when you have to do it, where you have to leave money or whatever. So there was uncertainty over what had happened. But the reason that there wasn't a second phone call or a third or a fourth or any other one was because Thomas Niedermayer was killed within 2 days of his abduction. He was actually only being held in a house that was about a mile away. The IRA had turned up at this house on St. Stephen's Day and basically told the people who lived there that they wanted them to move out because they had an operation going on. And the people had very little option but to comply with that demand. They moved out, and that's where Niedermayer was taken. He was brought to a room and he was left on a mattress for a couple of days. On the third day that he was there, he asked if he could go to the loo. When he was being taken to the toilet, he made a dash for it. He was overpowered. He was brought back into the room by four men. They sat on him. He was struggling, and one of them hit him twice with the butt of a heavy revolver. I seen the X-rays of his skull. And there were two severe fractures to his head, to his skull, and he became limp and was recognized to be dead. They contacted Keenan, who was living in another house and not living, but was staying overnight in a house in Belfast. He came and looked. He was very angry because he knew that he'd lost his bargaining card. And he instructed them to bury her Niedermayer's body in secret, and they were to tell nobody that they had anything to do with it. And so later that night, the body was moved to an area of public parkland. A shallow grave was dug, and her Niedermayer was buried face down. And one of the killers said they did that so that he could only dig himself deeper. His mattress was put over it, and then rubbish was emptied on top of it. Eventually, there were thousands of tons of rubbish on top of the shallow grave. And then they just went completely silent. They, in fact, not just silent, they issued statements saying that they had nothing to do with the abduction. And in what I think is one of the most cynical pieces, the leader of the IRA in Andersonstown said that they had instructed their volunteers to assist in the search for Needleman.
Well, really, I did especially tragic given that he was an outsider. He had no horse in any race, wasn't involved in anything. Employed Catholics and Protestants. Yeah, there's an extra level of like tragedy to that, I think.
Yeah,
On
I agree.
putting on like the hypothetical hat, let's say he hadn't tried to make a break for it, or they hadn't hurt him so badly that they killed him. Do you think they would have had any success in trying to get the Price Sisters over from England? I remember reading in the book that like even around that time, even Irish politicians kind of made an agreement with each other that like if one of us gets kidnapped, we don't no negotiating with terrorists, no handing anything over,
That's right. I think there are two aspects. There's a governmental approach, and it was, as you say, basically the British government and the Irish government had made a kind of pledge that they would not negotiate with terrorists who'd abducted people. However, Max Grundig took a different view. I mean, he assumed wrongly, as it happened, that the kidnappers were looking for money. And he basically sent his head of the chairman of his board over to negotiate what the fee was. He was willing to do a deal, except he thought the deal was he thought they were more conventional kidnappers, and he thought that all they wanted was a payment, which he was prepared to make. And that led to a degree of kind of uncertainty, because some people thought in the family thought that on the one hand there was the Grundig organization that wanted to negotiate, on the other hand there were the governments that weren't interested in negotiating, and that there was a tension between the two, which there was. But ironically, it didn't matter because he was dead. So there was, A, they weren't looking for money, and B, he was dead. So there was nothing to be negotiated effectively, But the problem was that they didn't, because they were denying that they had kidnapped him in the first place, they also couldn't reveal that he was dead. So what happened then was that for years, nobody knew what had happened to this guy. And that was very, very tough for his family, excruciating actually for his family.
You might fill us in there a bit on the eventual fates of the Price Sisters, who later actually did manage to get to prison over in the north with no kidnapping.
Yeah, I mean, there's an irony in that, the thing is that you're probably least likely to get the Price Sisters transferred if it was being seen to be done through coercive means. Once it became clear that the kidnapping sequence was over, the British moved them to Northern. In fact, they gave them early release. They'd been sentenced to 20 years. They only served 5 or 6 years each because they were given compassionate leave, so or release. So it adds another layer of irony, because it wasn't even necessary to kidnap anyone. They would have been sent back, which is what they normally did in any case. So because the British didn't particularly want IRA prisoners in their jails, they had to have them sometimes, but they didn't particularly want them. They would prefer if they were in Northern Ireland or the Republic. So they did eventually get back, but there was this 7 years hiatus. And I should say, incidentally, that the two sisters eventually broke with Sinn Féin over the Good Friday Agreement and the cessation of violence. They wanted the campaign to continue. Yeah, the 7 years were extremely difficult for the sisters and her native man's daughters and his wife. They went through dreadful experiences. For a start, there were constant rumors being circulated about what had really happened to him. The press covered it in a very irresponsible and reckless way. They gave credence to all sorts of fantasies about that he'd been involved in arms smuggling, that he'd been executed by loyalists, that he'd been a criminal gang had murdered him on a boat. I mean, it just was, and even more hurtful ones, that he'd run off with another woman, that he'd been killed because he was having an affair with a politician's wife, and even clairvoyants turned up at the house and claimed that they could tell Ingeborg where her husband was buried. They'd seen him in trances, and so for 7 years it was very, very grim for them. Even, you know, they had Ingeborg was quite a religious person, and she had attended the Lutheran Church in Belfast. There was one Lutheran church where services were conducted in German. She became uneasy attending that because other Germans felt that they might somehow be caught up in whatever had happened to him and were nervous. So she had to stop attending the church, you know, so, or felt she had to. But then, the 7 years after the kidnapping, there came the breakthrough that they had been waiting for, which was that, the RUC had brought in for a questioning a guy that they knew was in the IRA. Now, it was quite common for low levels of intelligence to be swapped by either IRA or UVF people in return for dropping relatively minor charges against them, you know. So this guy said to the RUC inspector who was questioning him, this is the name of a man that you should look out for. He's not known to you, but he plays an important part in the IRA." A couple of weeks later, they arrested this guy, and they gave him the code name of Disciple. And Disciple had a very important role in the IRA in Belfast. He basically had to go around all the different units, find out who was doing what, when it was going to be done, etc., etc. So basically, they did that because they didn't trust telephones or other forms of message. So it was all done by word of mouth. As a result of that, Disciple knew basically every member of every unit in Belfast. He also knew what operations each one had been responsible for over the last 2 years. This was very, very valuable information. So he agreed that he would become an informant to the police, and they released him without charge. After he was released, he began to think that he would be a victim of his former comrades. So he skipped Northern Ireland, and he went to England. But his wife contacted the RUC and said that he was still interested in passing information to them. So an RUC inspector and a member of MI5 met him on the Channel Island of Jersey, where he was on board a ship and working as a chef or a cook. And over a period of 3 days, he would get off the ship after he'd served or made lunch or dinner or whatever, and he would meet his handlers. And over the space of 3 days, he gave them 80 pages of closely written notes detailing everything he knew about recent IRA operations in Belfast. So this was very, very valuable material. In the course of this, he happened to say that he knew where Niedermayer's body was buried. And when they asked him about that, he said that he'd been in a pub or a shebeen in Andersonstown one night, And he'd been talking to a guy who had been involved in the kidnapping, and he had told him where he was located. Now, the IUC at this stage had a pretty good idea of who had been involved in the kidnapping from other sources. And the information that Disciple gave them was regarded as credible because it reinforced information and confirmed information that they already knew. So they now, ha and they had been received it from a number of sources, including sources in America of people who had been in the IRA and had moved to America. So they regarded this as credible information. But the place he was buried was very close to Anderson's town, which was the center of IRA activity. So they had to work out how they were going to excavate the body. They set up a fictitious environmental organization. It had its own office, it had its own logo, it had its own press releases, and they announced that they were its purpose was to reinvigorate this area of parkland that was near to Anderson's town. When they went there, they found that there were tens of thousands of tons of rubbish over the position that they knew that they now believed that Niedermayer was buried in, and it took them 4 weeks and excavators to get rid of all that rubbish. But underneath it, eventually they found his body, and he had been buried face down, as their informant had told them. And it was confirmed by forensic evidence that this was Niedermayer. Two people have been charged. Them was a guy called Bradley. Bradley was a relatively low-level member of the IRA. He'd actually, but when he was brought in for questioning, he'd actually left the IRA. In fact, and he said part of the reason that he left the IRA was because of his horror at what had happened to Niedermayer. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 20 years in jail, which actually is a very, he was only charged with manslaughter because by the time the body was recovered, it was sufficiently decomposed for them to be uncertain with absolute 100% conviction that it was the blows to his head. All they could say was that he died immediately after the blows to his head, but they couldn't say that that didn't precipitate a heart attack or something like that. So he was given 20 years, which actually surprised the IUC. They thought he was only going to get about half of that sentence. The other guy was a guy called McManus. He was a senior member of the IRA. He wasn't actively involved in the kidnapping. He was the person whose home Keenan stayed in that night, and he was, it was he got only got 4 years for withholding information, but they brought in the whole bunch of the people who were involved, with the exception of Keenan, because Keenan at that time was actually in jail in England. They brought in the rest of the gang. One of them had actually accidentally killed himself, shot himself in the head by accident shortly after the kidnapping. They brought in the others, but basically the ones who said nothing, literally nothing, went convicted. The ones who admitted to it, including Bradley, served a very long sentence. But Keenan was never formally charged with it, partly because he was serving 18 years in prison in England, and they didn't think it was worth pursuing it,
I was gonna say, you might kind of close the bow on Brian Keane, and what became of him after the kidnapping?
Well, after the kidnapping, his career in the IRA continued to prosper, if that's the appropriate word, and he ended up as chief of staff. However, he was arrested in 1979 at a roadblock in just outside Banbridge in Northern Ireland. It was quite strange that he was arrested in these circumstances, because normally he travelled in a convoy. There was an advance car, there was his car, and there was another car behind him. And the advance car was basically to give warning if there were any police roadblocks or anything like that. In this case, the advance car, there was a roadblock, but they let the advance car through and then they stopped Keenan's car, which suggests the car was clean. In other words, it had no prior form, so to speak. So they believe that only a very small number of people knew Keenan's movements. He was the leader of the IRA Army Council, so he wasn't exactly advertising where he was going. So it seems probable that there was a high-level informant who told on him, because not only did they know where he was going, but they deliberately let the advance car through without stopping it, which suggested that they knew exactly what was going on. He was convicted of his role in 8 murders in England. There was forensic evidence that linked him. Incidentally, I mean, some people believe that it was a mark of Keenan's own vanity that he had gone to England to supervise IRA activities, because normally Army Council members were considered too valuable to take part in actual operations. They were normally, not going to get involved at that level of operation. But Keenan was a very forceful, active person, and I've been told that he enjoyed being close to the action and seeing it. So he'd been in England and he'd been supervising this gang and this one particular group of people who became known as the Balcombe Street Gang. They were all arrested, and he was arrested in Banbridge and immediately moved to England, where he was tried. The Balcombe Street Gang got 40 years each because they're involved in multiple murders. He wasn't involved in actually these particular killings, so he was in on conspiracy charges, but he got 18 years. He conducted his own defense, and from the dock he made a 2-hour speech, which basically said that he had nothing to do with the IRA. He was a community worker. He was in England trying to understand the taxi trade and possibly buying a taxi, et cetera, et cetera. And he was considered so important to the IRA. At that time, it was IRA policy that if IRA members were tried by British courts, that they would not recognize its authority. He was allowed to recognize the court, and and this was could then be cited as evidence that he wasn't in the IRA, because he wasn't following that thing. They also sent a special unit over to England of highly experienced operatives to spring him from Brixton Prison, but once again there was an informant who revealed their whereabouts, and they were all arrested and imprisoned. Actually, they were imprisoned for longer terms than he had been imprisoned. He served 12 years eventually in prison in the north of England. Actually, ironically, the prison was close to the place where his father had served in the RAF.
Interesting, interesting. Fantastic book. I'd highly recommend. I highly recommend anyone read it. Goes into way more detail, obviously, than we spoke about. You'll learn not only about this case, but about the troubles generally. Like we talked about that post World War II Germany that Niedermeyer came from. Brilliant book. Can't recommend it enough. I usually ask this at the beginning, but I'll ask at the end. Why this particular case as something to choose to go into that much detail and actually produce an excellent book about?
That, well, thank you for the compliments. I mean, it was just a, it was a it was a story that just stuck with me, that kind of snagged in my brain, because it seemed such a, every story in the North has its own sadness, its own tragedies, and its own long-term effects. But this one in particular, partly because of the fact that Niedermayer was a complete innocent, It was as if he had stumbled into a domestic dispute and had ended up being killed, but also the long-term consequences for his own family, which led, as you know, to the suicides of his wife and two daughters. And they were also innocent victims of the North. And quite often people forget the collateral effect, the kind of ripple effect that violence has, not just on the people who are its direct victims, but on people who are related to the victims. And in fact, even the worst effects of any kidnapping are not usually on the person who's kidnapped, but on their families who are in an agony of uncertainty about what they need to do, what they can do to get their loved ones home safe and sound. That's a really torturous experience.
Yeah, God, I can only imagine. I've not to just juxtapose Nita Meyer's case to Don Tidy's, but in Tidy's they got the hostage back, but a guard and an army man lost their life, and in this case there was no one else lost their life in the attempt, but the hostage. The hostage idea was particularly sad. Is there any other cases or people or anything related to the conflict in the north that you would that you think of writing a book about maybe in the future?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the when you're writing a book about the North, you have to kind of immerse yourself in what happened during those years, which is pretty grim. And you know, I wrote a book some years ago about Irish, the role of Ireland in the Second World War. As a result of that, I had to read a lot of books about the Nazis. And I remember when I finished writing that book, of going into a bookstore and thinking, I don't have to read any more books about the Nazis. You know, it's a little like that with the Troubles. You know, I immersed myself in reading about the Troubles. Some terribly, terribly sad stories. The daughter Renate, who opened the door to her father's kidnappers, she found it extremely difficult to get over feelings of guilt and personal responsibility. And I remember when I was working as a current affairs producer in RTE that I once had to interview, or tried to interview a boy whose father had been killed in the Troubles. And he told me that his father was a zookeeper. He was also a part-time police reservist. And one Saturday morning, there was a knock at the door or a ring at the door. He opened it, and a guy, a postman, was there and said, "I've a letter for your father." And he said, "Oh, I'll give it to him." And he said, "Well, it's a registered letter. He has to sign for it." And he said, "Well, he's asleep in bed." And he said, "Well, will you go and get him?" He went up, he got his father, a guy called Connolly, and he came downstairs and he opened the door and the guy shot him and then ran off. Now, I tried to interview that guy about 15 years after that. And we had the film crew set up and started to ask him. He couldn't talk about it. It was 15 years later, and he was 12 at the time that it happened. And there was no interview that we could do. And afterwards, I spoke to his mother and I said, I didn't want to distress him. I hope it didn't, cause him too much pain to go through this. She said, he feels that he should have run after the guy. You know, those are the sort of things, and that's what happened to Renata. She found it very, very difficult that she had actually fetched her father down to be killed, and that basically ruined her life, you know. And I suppose that I don't want, if I can avoid it, to go back into that darkness and sadness and tragedy. There are a lot of stories that deserve to be told. I'm not sure if I want to tell them myself again.
Interesting. I completely know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean. Good. Thank you for
Okay.
everything, David. I'll link the book, the YouTube and the podcast for anyone anyone who's listened this far. You'll love the book. Fantastic stuff. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you. All the best.